Hi, this is Tessa from Don't Forget the Bubbles. This talk was recorded live at DFTB 18. Enjoy the show.
All right, without further ado then, we'll get on with our first speaker for today, and it's a real honour for me to introduce my fellow West Aussie, Professor Fiona Wood. Now, Fiona, for those of you that don't know, was former Australian of the Year, burn surgeon, and intimately involved in a lot of amazing research that goes on in burns in Australia and around the world. But my connection with Fiona is a little bit different in that I was her husband's anaesthetist for about 4 years. We'd come up to the country and we'd talk about all sorts of stuff. So I kind of feel like I know her a lot better than I do because I just met her last night, because I've heard all of the in and out goss over the drapes over the years. So with that, Fiona, welcome to the stage.
Well, thank you very much, Casey. I was just bracing myself there for some of that gossip over the drapes. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to share some of the work we've been doing in WA and around the place over the last, 30 years now, and to share some of those ideas with a group that I think is very important, because our children are our future. Thank you very much. I knew I'd forget something straight off the bat. So to really specifically target burns in children, I think, is very, very important, and I hope I will impart that to you in the next 20 minutes. Every intervention from the point of injury will impact on the scar worn for life. This, if you come to work with us in WA, will be tattooed somewhere where you can, of your choice. Along with the quality of the outcome must be worth the pain of survival. And so we focus very much across the spectrum. We teach first aid into schools. We do basic science. We look at population health science. We do a whole lot of different things with the understanding that at every point we have to pay meticulous attention to detail. We have to use what we know. And let's face it, facts in medicine, if you find one, hang on, because there's not many of them. You know, opinions are, fly around left and right, but facts, if you find one, hang on, and I'm going to share a fact with you now. If you cool a burn between 15 and 18 degrees of clean, cool running water within 1 hour of injury, a pediatric scald will be reduced by 80%. In a big data, a piece of work we did across Australasia, if adequate first aid is administered within the first 3 hours of injury in that particular database, you will reduce your length of stay in the hospital and in intensive care. You will reduce infection rate. You will reduce the incidence of surgical intervention. Point of fact is you'll get better quicker because you've cooked less. And if I was in a high school now, I would have my thermos flasks and my asparagus, and I would be blanching my asparagus. And you'd all know that, yes, if you don't blanch the vegetables, they're soggy, like they were at school dinners. Yeah? And so here we are, understanding right, very simple first aid makes a difference. I could tell you and bore you to death about the Wnt pathway and programs and apoptosis and how we can manipulate it, but point of fact is, clean, cool running water does it better than anything we've found to this point. So getting the basics right in everything matters. Paying meticulous attention to detail and understanding your subject really does matter. And this is where I started, and I'll try and tell you my story, around a couple of stories, in fact. This is a young boy I met in 1985, and I've carried his picture around with me ever since. 1985, I was young, enthusiastic, absolutely, driven to change the whole paradigm of scarring forever for everyone who actually has the misfortune of their life changing in an instant. And this young boy was pivotal in that, the N equals one. He came to from London to East Grinstead. East Grinstead was a place where we had Archibald McIndoe in the Second World War collecting together all the Air Force personnel who were burnt. And he collected them together and he rebuilt them. Young men whose lives had changed in an instant. They were called the Guinea Pig Club, and I met a number of them. And then I met this young man, and I'm looking at the guinea pigs, and I'm looking at this young man, I'm thinking, oh my goodness me. Survival, the quality of survival. Certainly, to survive a burn in a developed country in this day and age is possible in the main. The incidence of major burns is falling. Our capacity to retain vital organ function is much better than it was and continues to improve. But then it's left. How do we fix the skin? How do we actually get that skin to heal? How do we actually regenerate? How do we understand regeneration? I know, and I've thought a lot about regeneration over the years. And lizards, you know, if you pull a tail off, it'll grow the same spots in the same place. But you damage that nerve, it will just be a disorganized blastocyst. So what's happening there? That's a whole nother story about the nervous system and how maybe one day we'll be able to think ourselves whole. Because I know, if you're burnt here, your nerves change here, your brain changes here, and all your spinal dorsal root ganglia change. Why is a little more elusive? So we started on this journey of cell-based therapies for me in 1990. I was a young registrar, and I was driving down Wellington Street, for those West Australians, from PMH then to Royal Perth. And there was a lady in the Royal Perth Hospital, 56 years old, with a 75% body surface area burn. She was falling through our fingers like sand as the waves of infection came over and over, and she weakened. I heard on the radio that here in Melbourne, they'd gone to Boston, and they'd been able to bring back the technology to take a piece of skin, a postage stamp of skin, and to grow it into a sheet. That technology, now it took 3 weeks then, it still takes 3 weeks now. We took the last little piece of skin from under the arm, sent it to Melbourne. I sometimes think that this was the straw that broke the camel's back around Ansett, because they did everything for free for us. And so they flew back, Prof. John Masterton and Joanne Padalinetsky, the scientists, and we've put the skin cell sheets over this lady 5 months post-injury. She healed. She was on the burns unit rehabilitating when she had a sudden cardiac arrest on a Wednesday afternoon, from which we couldn't resuscitate her. I was at the arrest, and I always had a thought as a youngster, you never leave you never stop until everybody's sure you stop. And I know I kept going a bit longer, because I just couldn't let go. I had called in so many favors. I had tried so hard. Yet I was faced with the ultimate failure. And I learned something enormous that day that has really helped me in my path of seeing a lot of trauma over my 30-odd years. And I learned that however hard it is for me and however bad I feel, it is a fraction of how the family and friends of that individual feel. And I looked down the corridor, and that's where, to the visitor's room, because that was my next place I had to go. And I learned another thing that day. As I went in, all I can tell you is that I will learn from this, such that others will not suffer the same. And again, that's a mantra that, you know, is probably tattooed somewhere on me, if I to look. But always learn from today to make tomorrow better. That is where, that should be in our DNA. We have a privilege to treat people. It should be part of that is a responsibility to always seek to do better. Not because today is bad, but because it is the platform from which we move to make sure tomorrow is better. And so I look at this image here of the cells being sprayed on a wound and a kit that we developed. And that is 15 years of my life in one picture. Because the one thing I absolutely knew, a fact, is time to healing influences outcome, non-negotiable. And we've done a lot of research in this, and we've published it very extensively in this, the time to healing influences outcome. And so we took, Marie Stone and I took the basic technology in 1993, and our first cell sheets took 10 days to grow. We noticed watching that the cells that were, the sheets that were like moth-eaten, they did better. What's going on? We looked at the basic science behind the integrins on the keratinocytes. And again, I shut the doors. I could talk till you turn to dust about this. And then, yeah, sorry, I'd need to get out more. And then we realized that if we harvested the cells at 5 days and put them on as a suspension, that they would work even better, but how to get them on. And we don't know which one of us said it. I came out, we operate at 34 degrees because temperature regulation is, again, thermoregulation is a big area of our research because it is lost in this circumstance. And I walked into the lab where Marie, beautiful Marina, in the air conditioned lab, and I was looked like I'd been hit by a bus. And we go, oh, gee, I'm not sure which one of us said it, but we go, we should just spray this stuff on. And it was like a cartoon, dust. And we were both gone. I was upstairs, and I raided the anesthetic trolley, and anything that sprayed. She was down in Rockaby Road, the Jackson's Art Store, the pharmacy. And that nozzle, the nozzle you see before you, actually came from an Italian mouth freshener. We found the makers of this Italian mouth freshener. And when Remo Papini, our first fellow in 1996, arrived from Birmingham, so with a name like that, you've got to be able to speak Italian. Can you just tell them we don't need the mouth freshener, we just need the nozzles? And we became experts in the sort of nozzle vortexing and aperture of the nozzles, which influenced cell viability. And that nozzle clipped onto a standard syringe with no dead space and maintained in excess of 90% viability of the cells coming through the system with functionality. It was just like, oh, and it's still the one used. We then saw that our smaller burns weren't as good as our big burns, so then we put that technology into a box, took the box to the bedside, and we changed the paradigm, because now we use that cell box, the cell resell kit, on a daily basis. It's used around the world now, and that takes 20 to 30 minutes. And what we see, if it changes. Oh, well, what we see, should I dispense with this? No? Is basically 80% of our pediatric cases going to surgical intervention have no visible scarring. And I would show you that maybe later. But, oh, there we go. If you could change it for me, that's fantastic. Thank you. But really, I wanted to move forward from that story. We spent a lot of time trying regeneration, not repair, facilitating, putting activated cells from the dermal epidermal junction into the wound, changing the time of healing, reducing the time to healing with a very low risk surgical procedure, because we take a postage stamp as a donor site and we don't debride all the tissue away, we try and seal the surface. So we were able to change the paradigm. We thought we had done a grand job. But what I'd really like to share with you this morning is the second story. The N equals one, as I've shown you one of my N equals one images. There we are. This is 80% of our patients in the Children's Hospital have no visible scarring, but I can tell you underneath there is vascular abnormalities, neural abnormalities, and immunological abnormalities systemically. And why do we know? Because every intervention impacts the scar worn for life. And so when we look at this young child who's, you can see on the chest there, it's more superficial, but it's the cap of the shoulder. So over the shoulder, you see it's much deeper. And we're able to facilitate change, but it wasn't the answer. In 2003, I met a young man. He was 8 years old. He had 80% body surface area for flame burn on a farming accident. He was stopped, dropped, and rolled in chicken manure. It was a tough gig, but he was a tough kid. And he healed, and we thought we'd done a fantastic job. We were all clapping ourselves on the back, team hug, fantastic. We've done the best that technology had available at the time. And his mum rang me about 18 months later. There's a country boy. He was back paddling canoes on outdoor ed camp and all this sort of stuff, and riding his horses and everything. And so she rang me and says, it's getting a little tight, it's growing. And for those of you know in burns, with the children and the major burns, it's trying to get the scar soft enough so growth is possible without surgical intervention, and timing the surgical intervention to get enough release so that they can then have another growth spurt. I walked into the clinic, and I could see from the door that there was a mass in his right upper quadrant, and it wasn't the tight scar. He died as an 11-year-old with a hepatocellular carcinoma with no risk factors. Where to go? However I felt, I only had to look to his parents to know it was a fraction of what they would have to live with for the rest of their life. And so, where do I go? Never forget him. Never forget the N equals one. It can change the lives of others. That lady, the 56-year-old, I can absolutely tell you she changed the lives of others, because the LD50 for major burns, for burns in Western Australia, is 80 to 85%. So we expect 50% of our 80%ers to survive. And so she changed the paradigm. He has changed the paradigm because I could not let it go. We presented this case report around the world. Some of the older guys like me says, yeah, I remember a case like that. We thought we were looking for major burns. West Australia is very, very strong in data linkage. Play to your strengths and nag them. Nag your mates until they capitulate is my advice. By 2009, we had an NHN MRC grant to answer the question, does surviving burn injury, which could have lead to an increased risk of malignancy down the track? And it could be anything, in the injury or any of the interventions. And I can tell you now that the answer is yes. Surviving a burn injury will change your life trajectory. Your Kaplan-Meier curve is changed. But we've published again widely in this area over 30 papers, cardiovascular, musculoskeletal, neurological, gastrointestinal, mental health is shocking. Even when you remove all those with mental illness beforehand, we still have a significant six-fold increase in admissions for mental health diagnosis after your recovery from burn injury. And the most difficult thing for us to cope with is that 96% of the children in the database of 34,000 that we've linked with the data of 120,000 non-burnt age, sex, geospatial, and socioeconomic matched. And so 96% of the kids under 15 and 84% of the adults are not major burns. And there is a statistically significant change. We've also now got a 34,000 injured population, severity matched, not burnt. So, for example, but injury severity matched, so a small burn is like a closed fracture of an arm, et cetera, et cetera. We've spent a lot of time on severity matching. And I can tell you, post-trauma, you can see a light. We can see statistically that there's a change in your life trajectory. Post-major trauma, it goes up. It's about a third of the way down. Burns is much more inflammatory. We know that. It's a fantastically inflammatory event that perpetuates this inflammatory response that overwhelms the immune system acutely. But we see the change long term. So right now, what I put before you is that we have got a problem. We absolutely know that scar is abnormal. It's abnormal in its phenotype. The cell phenotype is abnormal. It produces an abnormal architectural framework. We know that it's tolerated by our immune system. But we also know that the changes in malignancy are really related to death from rather than the incidence of primaries. And it's a metastatic problem. So we're currently using the technique of heavy water drinking and punch biopsies of skin, of normal skin and scarring, to understand the turnover in the extracellular matrix, to try and understand what is making this extracellular matrix conducive or changed in some way, remote from the burn. Because it's not just skin I'm talking about, it's systemic. And what is the role of regeneration in all this? Yeah, I've spent my life closing down scars, closing them down. Our next program is 3D bioprinting full thickness of skin on the body site, taking not just the cells, but working with our engineers and with our chemistry, extracellular matrix chemists, to actually spray the whole of the skin. And, you know, maybe I'll see it before my surgical lifetime's over, but we will see it at some point. Bedside bioprinting will be possible. And it's important that you keep dreaming, because you start putting down the paving stones in the, that lead towards these things. So is it regeneration matters on one hand. It matters from function. It matters from how you, your form and function. But what is the impact of the stress? Stress of burns is enormous. I often see the teenagers as they come back and they're a bit sassy and I go, you know, you will never remember this. You don't remember this event, but your mum and dad will never forget it. Yeah, you know, the stress permeates. It's like a stone you put in the pond, it permeates through. And so trying to understand the role of stress at the macro all the way down to the cellular level is really important. We've collected together a group of 50 so far, children that have been burnt between the ages of 1 and 3. We've taken their blood between 5 and 8. And every one of them has got a raised TNF-alpha. Every one of them's got an altered gut microbiome, from what we can see. They haven't responded to their vaccinations as you'd expect, and that's our next piece of work. And it was basically, from Ian Fraser, said if you're checking out what the immune system is, give it something to do. These kids will have had vaccinations, see if they've responded. Of that first 50, 6 have got visible scars, that's all. You know, so where do we go with this? So we started working with IBM Watson Drug Discovery Platform, interrogating it, burns and cancer, and it's kind of smoked. It's too big a question. So we've broken it down and looked at fibrinogenesis related to this genetic work we've done of the top 1,000 genes. We put that against in the IBM Watson Drug Discovery Platform. If you've ever seen this, it's ingested the whole of the world's medical literature, including patents and including pharmaceutical trials. And we've come up with a list which is which drives fibrinogenesis, altered fibrinogenesis, remote from the burn in the extracellular matrix. In that top 10, 6 are neurologically related about patterning. And so understanding the capacity of the collaborations out there is my next message to you. You go from N=1 to the world's medical literature. Funnily enough, I can't read that in a night. And so to have the capacity to work across boundaries is fundamentally important in our future. Because I think it's really so important that we always question, that we never forget those experiences that make us feel uncomfortable, that we understand that where we live is one of privilege. Our education and training has given us an opportunity to change lives. When you put it that bluntly as that, that's what we do, day in, day out. With that comes responsibility. A responsibility, not to just to that individual in front of you, but to all of those who are going to come subsequently. I think, for me, I've lived as a surgeon. I've lived in a space where I've asked why. And I know it's beyond my pay grade. I couldn't drive the IBM Watson Drug Discovery Platform. I can't drive the animal model analysis that we're currently doing, looking at how we've seen that with a 1 centimeter burn on the back of a mouse, the metastasis rate increases. But I know its value. I know its power. And I know that there's enormous amount of technology and out there just waiting to be mined, waiting to be harvested. And so many of our scientists say, what we need is a clinical outlet. So don't forget N=1, and don't forget, there's a lot of friends out there who are really, really, really keen to help you. Thank you very much.
All right, if anyone has a question, I'd like to come to one of the microphones. Oops. Please do so now. Don't rush. And I've got a question for you, Fiona.
Just stand back up.
I'm one of those clinicians that works at the bedside, and you know, you have those moments where you think, oh, that's weird. And what practical advice would you give me if I was sort of wanting to take that question further? Like I work in a small country town, but how would I go about pushing that question further up the research ladder?
I think that's a... I guess that is fundamental, isn't it? It's that you can't let something go. And I sort of alluded to the fact that I could nag for Australia and Great Britain combined, because I think one of the things I've learned as you go along is that criticism without engagement in problem solving is a black hole. Don't go there. So if you ask somebody for advice or help and they go, oh, that's rubbish, walk away. Don't even waste your time trying to explain it. You've only got so many heartbeats left and so much oxygen, right? So you've recognized deadwood. Recognize deadwood early. Don't waste your energy. But don't let it go. Go and find someone else. You know, these days, Google. Find the world's expert. I get all sorts of interesting emails from all over the place these days, and I send them too. You know, I mean, there's a kind of network out there of people that, oh, that's interesting. When I went to around the 3D printing, and I said, no, I'm not interested in printing skin in a lab, because if I got it in a lab, that was like taking me back all those years, you know. I took the lab to the bed. What I want to do is take the whole thing to the bed. And then you see most of that you see, you know, on the internet, right? I've asked this question to all these people, there's all these people, and then you see the ones, even without knowing, they're the ones that have stood back, right? Because they've not answered you. But there's one or two that are really coming, sucker. Like, okay, whereabouts do you live? Yeah, and so making the effort and not letting it go. And I think it's easier these days because you can actually access people who have written in this area. And if you get a no, you don't have to believe it. I think that's really important. When someone says, oh, that can't be done, I'm a sucker for this. Oh, just watch. Yeah, just wait and see. So it's, again, that sort of keeping your energy safe so that when somebody says no and tries to knock you down, they don't actually floor you.
Okay.
It's not a KO. It's like, okay, then I'll find someone else.
Okay, good. Becky, do we have any questions from the Twitter sphere?
I have a question from Damien Rowland. He wants to know what you have for breakfast and where can he buy it?
You know, it's really funny because I'd have to say there's no substitute for looking after yourself. And it's boring stuff, isn't it? It's things like sleeping, eating, exercising. And I think, you know, though clearly I've had my knees replaced just over 3 months ago, so too much of a good thing can be a little bit of a problem. But I think it's been really important for me to pay attention to that, because with the 6 kids as well, it's pretty full on. And so in that space, sorry, that's who says I can't do surgery and have a family.
May
I tell just a small story about it? Just a
sure.
Really quick
one.
Sure,
put a minute, go for it.
I went, one of my kids' girlfriends was doing in med school, and two surgeons had come and given them career advice, male and a female, and had said in the room that if you're a surgeon, if you wanted a surgical career, that the women in the group had to consider that very carefully because it would impact on their life. And I go, what? He said, what? And so I rang the dean, and it wasn't a West Australian one, so you know, sort of under the sort of incognito. So you want to come and talk to our med students? Yeah. He said, right, okay. Anyway, so I went into, I said, oh, I'm just passing through. And so I went in, and I go, and I set off, and I said, right, guys, I just introduced myself, and I'm a surgeon, and I've married to a surgeon, and we have 6 children, and so I would like they're like all of those who are aspiring surgeons in the room to absolutely understand that unless you're committed to having 6 children, there is no point in trying to do surgery. And they all laugh, right? So okay, guys. So when somebody came here and told you couldn't, why didn't you laugh? Why didn't you say, oh, just watch? Yeah, because it is none of our business to influence others in that way. You find your own path, and you find it by connecting with people who want to facilitate you, who are connected with your energy. Don't waste it on those that are naysayers and negative. So that's my 2 pennies.